Today we're talking about, do world champions lose their minds? This is going to be about a history that's well over 100 years long. We're going to talk about different champions. And I thought I would just frame this by introducing just three reasons why maybe this is happening. Okay. First, the world championship match itself might drive people insane. We have, in the early days, we have Zukertort, basically, and McDonald basically almost dying, from the event. So it's so physically taxing that it's a kind of event that you might not recover from. And in our modern day, you know, maybe Ding is broken. We're going to talk about that. That might have something to do with the match. Okay, so that's point number one. Point number two is you have a pretty common trend of world champions, after they've been world champion, going out in public and making spectacular rants. And it looks real bad sometimes. Sometimes it looks better than other times, but in general, it looks real bad. I have some theories about what's going on there. And then finally, you just have the simple case that perhaps the people who reach the top, the very top especially, might be a little strange to begin with, right? So there's three reasons, I think, maybe Kosti and David will add some more, why this world champion thing could lead to madness. And so I thought we could just flesh it out, talk about different world champions, and then just see where people lie on this issue about people going insane. But I'll tell you what, before I hand it off, I'll say one thing. I do believe that it is a very taxing event. And Magnus, buddy, what always comes back to Magnus. The reason you have to go back is I think you're afraid, and I think it was so taxing on you, as I understand it is, okay? And all the world champions said it. Botvinnik said it, take a couple years off your life. Kasparov, similar things. It's so challenging as a sporting event is why the fans, not just the chess fans, but the people out there in the broader public want it. It's a death sport. It's literally a death sport. And it's why the public imagination understands that this is a new level of sport. It's not just your typical tournament. This is where people are being pushed to the limit. So Magnus, come back, buddy. I know it takes some courage, bud, but it's time to come back. All right, that's it. I did my Magnus rant.
Very enticing. You're basically telling him that it's going to kill him or make him completely mentally ill. And you didn't, no other motivation, just come back and get hurt for my pleasure.
No, I called him a wuss, dude, for not coming back. That's what I did. That's his motivation.
We really need a super edit of all the Jesse Magnus rants at this point. I think
that is really from the last century to bully people into self-harm.
That's where I'm from, my friend, the last century.
I know. And a long line of previous centuries before that. But yeah. I'm going to actually, before we get into the question of whether or not it does, I'm going to give two more reasons why winning the world championship could potentially lead to going crazy. So I'm going to add to Jesse's list of possibilities. So here's one option. You win the world championship and then you have nowhere left to go but down. You're at the top, the pinnacle, you've beaten everybody, and everything you do now is just a chance to lower your image, right? Mm-hmm. To lose people's respect and adulation and so forth, to reveal something that you probably know about yourself, which is that you are human and that you do make mistakes. And that you miscalculated some variations, but you got away with it, you know, and somehow you skated by. Because the world champions, they're all good enough to see their own mistakes, even if we can't, you know. And we've heard players of Kasparov and Carlsen's caliber complaining about how horrible and awful their play was, you know. So they're seeing the mistakes. So they know they're human. They know they could lose. They see how they could beat themselves every time they go out and play. And so the perspective of only losing, only going down, is something which I think can be taxing Not necessarily to everybody, right? But to certain personality types, that could be an issue, the prospect of going down. Also, for sort of like the coin flip of that is like nowhere left to go up, right? So like Jesse has often imbued meaning in his life by saying like, I need to get into this tournament or get my rating to here or qualify for that. Or, you know, he creates these quests for himself. And the meaning may be arbitrary, right? We don't know, but it keeps Jesse's psyche from collapsing. It keeps him getting up every day. It keeps him making healthy choices about his body in order to sustain his future mental performance levels, et cetera, right? It sort of like holds the whole guy together. So you could get to a point where there's no more quests to add on either, right? Like you did everything and now you have to ask yourself, was it all worth it, right? Like Jesse makes, you know, 2,400, then he tells himself, I need to make 2,450. And when he makes 2,450, he says, I need to make 2,500. But at some point, you're world champion and you know you're not going to make 2,900. And like, what's the next quest? And so you stop and you ask yourself, what were the last 30 years for? Did this actually have any meaning or any value? And I think we can discuss, but there may be a group of chess players who at some point reached the pinnacle and then had doubts about whether or not it had even been worth reaching the pinnacle or what the pinnacle meant. So that's another possible, not descent into madness, but ascent into madness.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
So, wow, yeah, a lot to get into there. So for me, it's kind of like, I guess, two things that I feel like have the biggest impact. One is, I guess, as David was saying, like the path is so strenuous and the world championship match is very difficult. As Magnus recently was talking about in the interview, he was saying how Ding like might be broken. And I think he was kind of, he's basically like saying like, yeah, people don't realize how hard these matches are. Like, that's why I'm like not into it anymore. And we can see like Ding, you know, has definitely kind of felt the effects of that. Although to their credit, I feel like Magnus's other opponents, especially like Caruana and Nepo, they don't seem to have been like destroyed from their matches necessarily. But anyway, one is just the difficulty of the candidates and the match, just the whole process. And as David was saying, like, yeah, just the sacrifices you have to make to get there. And then two, I would say like the weight of the crown. Like once you're there, there's nowhere to go but down. And it is a lot of pressure. And yeah, especially if you feel like you're getting older, the new generation is coming up, you're not going to be number one for much longer. There's nowhere to go but down. Like, yeah, I can see why that's that could be a problem. And then I guess maybe related is just like the not having the next quest. I think that's a big one that you guys brought up. I remember this interview that Fischer did after he won the world championship. And he's getting interviewed in the park. And I think it was like right after he won. And the interviewer asked him like, so like, what are you going to do now? And to me, it looked like Fischer like hadn't even understood that this question existed before this moment. Uh-huh. Like, what is he going to do after winning the world championship? And he kind of like thought about it for a second. He's like, well, you know, I guess I got to play a lot more chess. You know, I have a lot more chess I want to play. Like, that's what he says. Like, he has to play a lot more chess. And then, of course, he basically stop playing professionally completely. So yeah, there's a lot to it. Also, I thought maybe we could just make a brief list of some names that we're thinking about from the past. Not like a tier list, but just like some people that come to mind. Like for me, I think Morphe is one that people often mention as having mental problems. I feel like Alekhine might have been another one with like mental struggles. Of course, there's Fischer, and these are just the world champions. I think for me, a part of it is also just being obsessed with chess can cause people to have issues later on. So it's not just the world champions that I would think have struggles. But okay, in terms of the world champions, then you could also say, you know, a lot of people were angry at Kasparov for splitting off with Fide, and they could say that he maybe lost his mind doing that. Of course, now people are very upset with Kramnik, saying that he's losing his mind. Jesse's been very upset with Magnus. And I don't know if Jesse includes him in this list or not as losing his mind.
But I mean, those complaints are a little bit different than mental illness. I think Jesse's quibbles with Magnus not participating, or Kasparov splitting off with the PCA, is rather different than being in an asylum.
Yeah.
Okay, but let's just say
we can add to Kostya's list.
Yeah.
That he started, because Steinitz, the first official world champion, you know, depending how you see Morphy, second, right? Like, he finished up in an asylum. And then we have, you know, modern day, the sort of delayed mental collapse of Kramnik, and the immediate collapse of Ding. I mean, those could be immediately added to our list of world champions under consideration.
Well, and obviously the big one is Fischer too. That goes without saying, right?
Yeah. So big list, and we might have missed some. I was trying to think. I feel like at least we got the well-known ones.
I can list other world champions for you, and you tell me if anything pops into mind for you. But I went through the list myself and didn't think of anything.
Okay, yeah, I got a whole theory on this too. So first of all, I want to say about Morphy first. I just want to put this out there. A lot has come out, at least for me, that I didn't know when I was – there was a lot more information that now in the online world I didn't have when I was a kid. And I think from the modern-day perspective, what we have to say about Morphy is that he was probably what you could call trans. He was a trans man in a very homophobic society, and that alone could drive a person crazy. He was, you know, he was definitely like doing cross-dressing. He was living at his mom's house, wearing her clothes and all kinds of stuff like this, which for that time, you might as well be insane. Like, so in today's society, the guy probably would have done better. But what I'm trying to say is he doesn't fit the model of madness that I associate with the other players. Like, it's not chess that drives him crazy, as far as I can tell, right? Because there's a couple different strands of craziness. Mm-hmm. So, for example, like Ding's – one of the reasons I wanted to do this show is we're having this world championship match coming up, and Ding might be broken. It looks like if he is broken, it has something to do with being world champion in the world championship match, right? His madness, though, is completely different from Kramnik's madness. Right. So I just want to maybe talk a little bit about that. First of all, we have very little. No one has information on Ding. It's all just speculation. It's just that his results aren't great. He is going to play, I think, in Holland at the end of this month. You know, so we're going to see a little bit more of that. But hear me out with my theory.
Mm-hmm.
When you look, what's interesting is when you look at the Soviet champions, none of them really, they talked about how hard it was, but none of them lost their minds. Think about it. Botvinnik, Smyslov, Petrosian, Spassky, none of those guys lost their minds. It was only really until Perestroika started that we started to get a Fischer-style thing happening, which I think Kramnik is also part of, and this is what I mean. In the Soviet space, you weren't, as an individual, at all encouraged to sound off on your opinions. Mm-mm. That just wasn't done. Not even like Stalin and those top bureaucratic guys. They never like sounded off on their theories of the world, right? They always were very closed down in terms of that. But the second Perestroika hits, you got Kasparov and he starts saying some stuff. Whereas Fischer, of course, he's out there right away. And here's the thing that I think happens. When you're wearing the crown, you're going to get interviewed by a lot of people, and they're going to be approaching you as if you are someone smart. So the Dunning-Kruger thing is going to be in full effect. Like, you think you're amazing, and in a way you are. It's just that you might not know anything about statistics or history or anything. You might not have a clue, but you are going to be encouraged to think that you are a genius, right?
No, I think that's totally natural. Yeah, I just got to say, like, I feel like if I get 20 likes on my tweet, then, you know, I'm like ready to start a rant, you know, next to like, you know, on all kinds of stuff. No, I think that's very natural. I mean, especially once people start calling you a world champion and something you dedicated your life to.
Well, they also call you genius, right? Like, they never just say, like, so-and-so won the world championship. Like, he must have been working a really long time with single-minded dedication on one thing, right? They're always like, the mercurial genius, the brilliant blah, 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 you know? And, So, I mean, you get the word genius just flying all around your face.
Right. So this happens first with the Soviet bloc players, with Perestroika and Kasparov. And I don't know if I want to call Kasparov mad, but what does happen is he starts sounding off on all kinds of stuff. He's got a whole numerological thing, like believing in dates and having special significance. He, for a long time, and I think he might still believe this, he thought the medieval period was like a conspiracy, like it was like 300 years that didn't actually exist. You know, he's part of that conspiracy. He's got all these conspiracy theories, which for the most part felt kind of innocent. It wasn't like Fischer doing his anti-Semitic rant or something like that. But still, it was like, oh, Kasparov has these conspiracy theories. By the way, I think it's my just general belief that all of us have some kind of thing that could be considered a conspiracy theory. It's just we're not encouraged to sound off on it. Then these world champions sound off on it.
You know that there are conspiracies in the world, though, right, Jesse? Like, just because you have a theory doesn't mean you're wrong.
Yeah. Just because you're suspicious doesn't mean you shouldn't be, right?
Well, like, just Soviet players may have conspired against Fischer in candidates.
No. Totally
possible.
That's incontrovertible. They did. That's well established.
Okay.
No, that's, of course, Korshnoi said it afterwards, and all those other people said it too.
But, hey, come on, dude. Everyone knows that. Everyone.
Yeah, come on.
Well, now you've agreed with me that a conspiracy theory could be true.
No, of course. I'm just saying that when these people who have just mostly been immersed in chess hear something that seems plausible, then they start doubling down, right? And so in the latest instance, Kramnik has truly lost his mind. We had Kramnik on the show. And yes, is cheating happening online? Yes, it is. But then he starts accusing everyone, dude. And then he starts thinking he knows about statistics and how to prove stuff statistically. No clue. But because people tell him he's a genius and he's used to that, you know. Also, it's a hard thing, I think, in the modern world for Kramnik, where people, you know, when he's attacked, his instinct is to double down instead of to reflect, because he's like, I'm a genius. Of course I'm right. So we're getting off like this guy whose play, by the way, Kramnik was an amazing player, just an amazing player. And then he is truly spinning madly. It's definitely something like madness. Maybe he'll be able to tame it, you know, if he can just let this issue go. But he has truly lost his mind at this point. He's got to the point where you have a world championship champion banned from Chesscom because he's saying so much ridiculous stuff. Anyways, so big picture, there are different reasons, threads to the madness. And I just want to distinguish then the kind that I think if Ding is suffering, it's a different kind than Kramnik. Ding is not sounding off on anything, for example.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's interesting. To me, it does feel like there's some kind of like new height, new Everest they have to climb for some of these guys. And actually, for me, Kasparov and Kramnik are kind of similar, because Kasparov, of course, since retiring, he got into politics and he started basically trying to like fix Russian politics, essentially. That became his new like mission, like his new world championship. And for Kramnik, I kind of see like a similar endeavor, in where he's trying to like fix the problem of online cheating, which everyone does agree is a huge problem, possibly the biggest problem to chess, period. Yeah. Like an existential threat. Of course, the way he's going about it has upset a lot of people. And I don't know about the stats, but the stats people seem to say that he's like wrong on a lot of stuff. So I kind of trust them on that. I feel like they're like trying to like conquer like this like new height. And Magnus, a bit to me, he's like trying to like popularize the game. He's doing like the fantasy chess thing. I feel like he does have he's trying to change the game as well. Like, he's trying to make things faster, more games, chess 960. So he's definitely like, he's got loftier goals in mind than just trying to improve as a chess player anymore. But yeah, that's different than the world champions that let's say go a different way, lose their minds in a different route. And I wonder if that's more to do with them thinking that, like, maybe it's just me projecting, but, like, you know, chess isn't the best use of their time, like dedicating their entire lives to, like, a game, for instance, like, might not, and then suddenly they realize, like, why have I spent all this time, you know, and for what, like, for what, you know, did I do all this for? I feel like that's, I definitely wanted to discuss that because I feel like that's something that could afflict many top players. Basically anyone that spends a ton of time on it could, I think.
Yeah. You don't have to be world champion to at some point ask yourself, wait, I just spent 30 years of my life playing chess. Do I want to spend another 30? Like, have I done anything else? Yeah. Anyone can ask themselves that.
I think with Magnus, by the way, I feel like it's he's the one who used the word broken, and it's really a powerful word, and he's used it about Ding. But I think Magnus might be the one who's broken too, you know, in terms of just chess, but like that match, the match of the world championship, how the pressure, and it's like he can't do it anymore, you know. It's been like a scarring experience, even though he did so basically well in those events. The event itself was so strenuous that it scarred him in some way that at least for him, he can't even touch it anymore.
Yeah, I mean, I don't blame him for that. I feel like, I don't know, it just seemed like a slog, you know, day in, day out. You got to prep your openings for months and then try to memorize a bunch of stuff. And I get it. I mean, he's still playing chess, and he's won like every tournament he's played in, you know, like in last year. So he's still in form.
To me, everything Magnus has done is actually like a sign of good health, so to speak, and him not being part of any of the patterns we're discussing today, right? Because if he knows that it's hurting and he decides to stop it, like, that seems reasonable. And if he stops it before he goes crazy, that seems reasonable. He doesn't seem to be quote unquote broken because he's going out and playing tournaments all the time, right? He was playing two tournaments simultaneously this past week, right? The Superbet OTB Blitz and Rapid and the chess.com tour that was originally the Magnus tour, right? So I would say he's like an example of somebody who's making very good decisions for his own health. And he may have been close enough to all this stuff where he can see what can happen and he can understand Ding better than people who have not sat in that seat, right? But he may have sat there and pulled back, you know, without getting damaged by it in the same way. You know, but he'll have that understanding. Just like supposedly, you know, Karpov and Kasparov, who were enemies in a certain sense, they were also the only two people who could truly understand each other. So there was a level at which, you know, they had to talk with each other because they were the only ones who knew what the other person had been through in life.
Yeah.
With those matches.
Yeah, that's fair. So
I want to add an extra disclaimer to everything we're saying today, because Jesse mentioned that, you know, we can't really know. And, you know, when we're talking about Ding or something like that, it's speculation. I want to say, even when we talk about the historical figures, it's also speculation, right? There's some scanty historical records. When I looked up over the last 2 days, some stories which I had heard as a kid to verify them, I found many of them to be either just sort of urban legend or whatever. Like, it's not clear where they came from or what the source was, or they were under dispute. You can find articles by Edward Winter where he, you know, just says like, none of this can really be known. You know, it's all just this person made it up, and they quoted this person who made it up. And so I just want to say a lot of this is guesswork. We're theorizing about this, right? But there is a certain pattern.
Yeah.
And maybe we could go through now case by case a few players and sort of get a sense of whether we three think that there really is a pattern or not.
Sure. Yeah. But no, like the tie with what you said, yeah, there's no – we definitely don't know, especially like we don't know any of these guys super personally and have any sense. It's just kind of our perception. And and no judgment. I mean, we're all doing chess here full time, you know, so we're all in this together.
Well, I think, you know, obviously some cases we know better than others. I think, for example, that it's well known that McDonald and Zukertort died because of the world championship match and its pressures, right? Now, they didn't become world champions. Maybe that was part of it because they almost died. They couldn't take it. They did not become world champions. But those guys, dude, they're dead because of this thing, you know. So we do know, like, there's two cases. You can call it madness. You could also call it just the physical torture of the really long matches, especially back in the day. They played longer matches than they do now.
Right. If it didn't make them go crazy, but it physically killed them, then you still have a plausible explanation for why it could drive somebody else crazy.
Right.
Right. Right. Like, one person might die, but that torture could cause somebody else to go crazy. It would become quite plausible.
Right.
Let's talk Morphy for a moment.
Yeah.
Jesse, you already started on that conversation earlier.
Right.
Mentioning how he lived at home with his mother and how he you said, I don't know the source on this, but that he was like cross-dressing and it was,
right,
you know, really not of the time. I have another thought about Morphy, which is, I think he had a weird kind of, I think he's a prime example of a weird kind of tension about whether or not chess is worth it or not, or whether or not you know, how he felt about chess, conflicted about chess. Because first of all, it's famously known that Morphy thought that chess could only be an amateur pastime, not a professional pastime.
Mm-hmm.
Right. That's one of the reasons that he like never played, you know, a world championship match for money or something like that. It's one of the reasons he quit. Right. Like, there was something, he quit fairly early, and there's something about it where it's like he didn't think chess was a good use of time. And again, I'm speculating wildly here, folks, but I think we have an example of somebody with a very strong internal discord, where part of him probably loved playing chess and was just like thrilled to do something that was captivating and that he was good at, you know? And another part of him was like, would say to himself, like one of us might after a 10-hour blitz binge, right? You useless, useless sack of shit. What have you just spent 3 years doing in Europe? Like, you should have just gone and played one tournament and then come home and finished your law degree and done something like useful, you know? And I think that he had some kind of aristocratic values. Mm. He was from a well-to-do family.
Yeah.
I saw one story, which may or may not be true, that he tried to enlist in the Confederate Army and maybe was found like unsuitable for service and dismissed, like they didn't want him. He tried to start a law practice, perhaps multiple times, finding no success there. And so I feel like he may have felt like, I'm supposed to do X or Y. This is what I'm expected to do, or these are the values of my family or my understanding of my position in society. And he wasn't able to do that. He was able to do the chess thing, and he just felt weird and bad about it. And I think that could have been something crazy, because he kind of didn't do much with his life after quitting chess, but he kind of quit chess in order to try to do something else with his life, you know, which I think about all the time.
Right.
You know, and
right.
then wasn't able to. And, you know, crazy thing is, the year before he died, I heard he bumped into Steinitz on the streets and didn't want to talk about chess with him or play chess with him. A year before he died, Steinitz, you know, had just recently emigrated to the U.S., and like went to New Orleans, and perhaps it's not an accident. Like, why did he go to New Orleans? Maybe like hoping to see Morphy on the streets or whatever, you know, but that's like a crazy.
Well, no, they
in history that these two guys met and there was no chess.
Part of the match between Steinitz and Zukertort was
they were waiting.
They were in New Orleans. They went there kind of even to, you know, the promoters were like, let's go to New Orleans, get Morphy out. You know, I think it was New York, St. Louis, New Orleans. It was an epic match. Zukertort dies, dude. Yeah, I think actually that tension is very interesting. I feel like most of us, especially pre-Queen's Gambit, if you talk to family members or just people randomly you meet on the street and you say you're doing chess, they're like, no, that's not real. You know, so there's that sensibility of it not being something serious. And usually they'll couch it in terms of like, it's not serious because you're not going to make any money, you know. But and so I'm it's like a money thing that's it's couched in, but also like a not serious thing. And I think that's actually it's interesting to think back on that, because now that chess is really booming, if people find it far more understandable, at least in my daily interactions, than before, especially when I was a kid, dude. When I told you people I wanted to play chess, they were completely dismissive. You know, everyone was. So that's just an interesting thing, which I'm sure was the case when he was there in New Orleans. People didn't understand, you know, the idea of playing chess all the time. It wouldn't have even occurred to him.
I wonder if other sports went through a transition from amateur to professional where they had to gain acceptance. Like now you would never question why somebody chose to be a professional baseball player, basketball player, something like that.
Right.
But I wonder if there was a period where it was seen as like weird that your career would be sports person, you know, and maybe other sports went through a similar transition.
Yeah, for sure. Like UFC, like that's a newer sport that started off like not like super respected, but now it's like a huge, huge career option.
Yeah.
I think that's definitely common.
Did you recently get mated? Well, it's time to join the Chess Dojo training program. Or maybe you just enjoy this fine content. Give us some money on the Patreon. I need to keep the lights on. And with inflation, it's really hard for Kostya to be buying that avocado toast.
Okay. Well, so who's next on the list?
Well, okay.
Steinitz, actually.
Steinitz, yeah.
Steinitz.
And one thing about Steinitz's madness, you know, first of all, I think the guy was mostly together until the very end. There's some that we don't know exactly what's going on in the insane asylum at the very end. Like some people say maybe he had syphilis or something. I don't know. But I think what's interesting about Steinitz is nowadays you're as a player, you're judged basically on whether you win or lose. But Steinitz, oh, dude, when he started playing his new style in the 1880s, it was a war. It was a chess war. And there were people ready to challenge to duels because this fool was playing positional chess. And it was so hateful to the older generation of romantics that they were ready to die. They were ready to slay this dude. So there's like a whole period of tension in Steinitz's life that's even hard for a modern player to understand.
Right.
Yeah. Like
that his peers reviled him, right? And that they were writing attack pieces on hit pieces on him in the newspapers.
It even gets called the Ink War, and it's just like this whole thing, dude.
Yeah. I mean, Steinitz's situation also, let's say it's exacerbated by poverty.
Mm-hmm. By being Jewish? Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's funny, actually, with Steinitz, is like we don't, especially in the United States, basically, no one says our first real world champion was Steinitz. I mean, you think of him as German or you know, European, but ultimately, he won the title here. This is where it happened, you know, and he becomes an American citizen, as does Lasker, you know. But we don't think of them in this American pantheon.
Yeah.
At least I usually don't.
Yeah. From what I could read, Steinitz was crazy by the end. And there's a lot of details that are disputed here and there. Mm-hmm. You know, there's this famous story that like he was challenging God to matches and that he thought he had an invisible telephone that he could like talk to people on. So there's some details that, you know, some of them are questions, but some of them are, you know, referred to multiple times. And you start thinking the preponderance of evidence kind of leans in that direction.
Right.
Oh, I mean, I would say there's somebody who kind of lost it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that chess was kind of like a stressful part of his life, but also, you know, he mismanaged his finances and was kind of unlikable. So I don't know. There were other issues. And he also had a daughter who died with his first wife and a very, very young. And, you know, I think losing a child, especially if you only have one child, could certainly be a legitimate reason to lose part of your mind.
Yeah. Yeah.
So.
I think what's interesting after Steinitz is there's a remarkable period of mostly stable players. It's no one, I don't think anyone would call Capablanca insane. In fact, the guy is the image. It's the image of sanity, right? Mm-hmm. Lasker, for the most part, as well. He went on some interesting rants, but they weren't necessarily rants. He just had some ideas. Alekhine, maybe, but mostly I think that was alcoholism. Maybe somebody is going to contest that. But to me, it seems like the pressures of belonging to the Russian aristocracy and being booted from your country, you know, and then drinking a little heavily there in the Nazi regime, where he's then booted too after being expelled from Russia, basically.
Yeah. For my research, Jesse, Alekhine or Alekhine is kind of a counterexample. Mm. To me, he's the example of somebody who I heard was crazy as a kid. Mm-hmm. And then when you check the record more precisely, it doesn't pan out. And then it reminds you that there's a narrative, and a narrative has its own inertia, right? The narrative wants to claim people. Once you ask, you know, are all of these people like predisposed to being crazy, or does this put too much pressure on people? Suddenly you see, oh, this guy was under pressure and that woman went crazy and so on, right? You start finding it when that's how you framed it and you're looking for it. Right. And I know that when I was a kid, you know, chess players love to tell the most special chess stories, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, those stories, they're just tantalizing and exciting. You know, I heard a story that a Mexican grandmaster had like lost his mind and in the middle of a tournament ran into the corner of the tournament hall and defecated in the corner. And I searched the internet today and I couldn't find any reference to this story, and I knew his name. So I searched with the name and everything, and I couldn't find this story, you know. Uh-huh. And another story I loved was somebody saying, oh yeah, this guy here, he's so crazy. I was playing at a tournament once and he made a mistake and he got so mad he started stabbing himself in the head with his own pen, and there was like blood on like his score sheet and the board.
Oh, that's true. And I know who that is. Yeah.
Yeah. So these stories are somehow exciting and tantalizing, right? Mm-hmm. Like we collect them and then we pass them on. And if you have 10 conversations with other chess players, you can be sure that you're going to bring up that story, right? Because it's an amazing story, you know, or somebody throws up on the board and his opponent quickly makes a move, screws the piece in and slams the clock, you know, hoping the guy is going to lose time while he's ill. So all those kind of stories, they're so colorful. And I had heard that Alekhine was one of the crazies, and some story like, he tried to, you know, cross. Here's how I heard the story. He tried to cross a frontier, a border between nations, while naked in a snowstorm with only his cat under his arm, and told the crossing guards, like, don't you know me? I am the great Alekhine, world champion, you know, uh-huh. Get out of my way or something, when they wouldn't let him cross the border. Okay, sounds really insane, right? Uh-huh. But when I tracked the story down, all I could find is that he once made a trip to a tournament and left his passport behind. And when the people at the border asked, like, said, you don't have your passport, he said, I'm the world champion. Like, I'm Alekhine. You can recognize me. Like, I don't need a passport, you know? And then they had to talk to people and they verified his identity, and he was able to travel to the tournament without a passport. A far cry from, like, you know, wandering through a snowstorm naked, where you really sound insane.
I want to say about Alekhine is, in terms of a narrative, I feel like the Soviet bloc really, well, definitely, unquestionably, but they blacklisted him and Karas for being part of the Nazi regime. And, you know, especially in hindsight, too. And I first heard that, I was like, oh, he's a Nazi, that's terrible. Or Karas was a Nazi, that's terrible. But both of those guys, dude, were running from Stalin, and especially in history, it's like it's not even clear that Stalin was better than Hitler, dude. So it's like, especially for Estonia, especially for us, or if you're some aristocratic dude, you know, growing up there, you're going to get the guillotine if you don't run. So it's like, you know, anyways, I just want to say about those two guys that was definitely part of the narrative that has stuck. Because almost, and even the West too, anyone who associated themselves with the Nazis is going to have a problem. I think Karras is actually a very interesting player too. You could talk about the pressures of chess. Eventually the guy has a heart attack and dies, still pursuing the title at a later age, you know, rough.
Wait, so on the Alekhine thing, so David, did you get anything in your research on the whole Nazi thing? Because what I've...
I
have very little knowledge of this, but my understanding is that he wrote some pro-Nazi stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But there's questions as to maybe whether he was forced to write these things or under duress.
I haven't read the things, right? But they're supposedly sort of like hit pieces on Jewish chess players that are supposed to generate... you know, racist propaganda against Jews, right? There have always been a lot of Jewish chess players. And then the question was, did he really pen them or not? Was it his style? Was there like an encoded message in it saying that he was forced to do it or not? And that, I think, remains just sort of like really no way to know, you know, to what extent was he coerced or not.
Okay, I got to look into it because I remember reading something or someone was telling me, it might be again BS, but I remember coming across that there's like specific like chess mistakes in the writing that Alekhine inserted as like Easter egg, saying that he wasn't intentional about what he's writing.
Right. I've heard that claim, and since I haven't read the things myself, I can't verify that.
We got to look into it because.
But I stumbled across two interesting and fairly incontrovertible details of his biography. Which I think shed some light on this whole story. And let's mention that after World War II, you know, in these last couple of years of his life, he was sad and alone, ostracized, poor, like Steinitz, dirt poor, because like he was supposed to go play some London tournament. The American players canceled him. Everyone thinks, oh, cancel culture, it's this new horrible thing. No, he got canceled 80 years ago, you know. The American players complained that he was a Nazi sympathizer and shouldn't play in the London tournament. And they got his invitation canceled after he was already invited and was going to go play. So suddenly he couldn't play in any tournaments. He had no livelihood, et cetera. And I found some stuff about him sort of sitting around in a hotel room in Portugal, being very depressed. He was world champion, but like he couldn't make a living the way he wanted to. And there's some quotes from him about, you know, the world wars like ruined my life. And other people's lives too, obviously. It's not like he had no perspective or anything. But here's the very interesting thing I found, Kostya. You may know that war in Europe broke out during an Olympiad in Buenos Aires or somewhere in South America, right?
Okay. No, I didn't know that.
Which was an infusion of chess culture into South America because a ton of European grandmasters stayed in South America, notably like Miguel Nydorf. And so a lot of top European players stayed there. And in fact, apparently they had a meeting and voted on whether or not the team captains and voted on whether or not to play the Olympiad or go home or cancel it when war broke out. Aliekhine was team captain for France and he voted that they should keep playing the Olympiad and they did. But when the Olympiad finished, a huge percentage of European grandmasters stayed in South America. Aliekhine flew back to France and enlisted in the French army to fight against the Nazis. Then when France was defeated, he fled first to the south, to Marseille, and then to the Iberian Peninsula, to Spain, and then Portugal. And from there, he tried to escape to America and Cuba. So he wanted to flee to America, and he also asked for Cuba to accept him, with the condition and the offer that he would play a rematch against Capablanca if they would take him. Because you can't just get on a boat or a plane or whatever, right? Like somebody has to be willing to take you. So he was like trying to flee. Well, supposedly he was denied visas by the U.S. and Cuba, got stuck in Europe, and then ended up doing the collaboration of playing in Nazi-run tournaments. Whether or not the story about the articles and all that, he definitely played in Nazi tournaments and made his living throughout the war playing in German things. But it's very interesting that he flew back to France to fight them, right? That's a detail I'd never heard before and definitely has some suggestion to it, right? Of where he stood versus whether it was some coercion at some point.
Yeah. Yeah, sounds like more of a sane guy. Just caught up in a very, very bad time.
That's my take as well now, you know. And to me, it's like an example of how the stuff can get exaggerated to match a narrative that we expect.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right.
And then, my friends, I think one of the most interesting parts of the story for me about this topic is just that stretch of Soviet players that are not insane. Maybe they are, but they aren't allowed to speak. You don't know. And they just, like, they're just in their little chess bubble. No one is allowed really to say anything until Perestroika. So you have this period from Botvinnik through to Karpov where no one is saying anything except Korchnoi. But that only happens when Korchnoi leaves, right? That he's allowed really to speak. And then Korchnoi, we could talk about Korchnoi's madness. The guy was definitely a mean bastard. Okay, was he insane? I don't know, but he was definitely a mean bastard on a level that it's hard to even comprehend how mean the guy was.
Yeah, Jesse, when I went through my list of world champions, I went through that same thing, and I was like, Botvinnik, Smyslov, Tal, Petrosian, Spassky, Karpov. I was like, they all seemed normal and fine. Like, they just played chess, and then they played more chess, and then they played more chess. But are you suggesting that if one or more of them had been crazy, maybe we wouldn't even hear about it because there would have been no external like evidence? They would have not, you know, there'd be no.
Well, this is what I think. I think that one of the reasons people lose it is because they are seen as somebody godlike. And then people, journalists and such, people at a party will ask them for their opinions. They sound off on those opinions and then they double down. They just double down and double down. And we saw that definitely with Fischer. And these people, even at whether you think their opinion is right or wrong, they don't question themselves. They have no sense of reflectivity. For example, Kasparov, I think a lot of the things he says are totally sane, but has he ever changed his mind on anything? No, he speaks with absolute confidence, as if there's no chance he could be wrong on the myriad of topics he talks about where he has zero background, just zero background, right? And so that's what we see with Kramnik going on too, man. You know, and he's just doubling down. He can't be wrong. He can't even imagine that maybe some statistics thing, which he has no clue of, might be wrong, you know? Mm-hmm. And instead, he's like telling people who are stats geniuses, really, people with a lot of experience, that they're idiots. Imagine, dude. That'd be like some, you know, 800 player telling a GM that they had no clue. What are you saying, buddy? No, you're the one with no clue. But they can't even imagine.
Or Jesse and other parents will get this immediately. It's a six-year-old telling their parent, like, no, you're wrong. You don't know how cars work, you know?
Oh, dude, my five-year-old mansplains me all the time, dude. That dude mansplains.
That's problematic, place. Jesse. You gotta talk to him about.
So
it's interesting about those Soviet guys. I feel like there was less stress, and this is just a theory, but, you know, maybe a lot of their games were kind of prearranged, so there wasn't like this tension, you know, they had going in. Oh, will I win? Will I won't win? What's, you know, a lot of their games, like,
they do
show
in advance.
Up, they know they're gonna they make a draw, or they know Botvinnik's gonna win the tournament, you know. So it's just like, maybe there wasn't. I don't know. I'm just saying. I don't know. I feel like there's so much history that's like uncovered, but.
Well, actually, on that note, I think it's really interesting. You know, I'm big. I've studied a lot of Smyslov. Big fan of his. And I didn't understand, and no one did until much later, that Zurich 1953 was fixed. And Bronstein is the loser in this situation. He doesn't say anything. He doesn't say anything until after 1990. And so that's been brewing. That's been brewing resentment for decades in this man's soul that he was cheated out of the world championship. He claims, too, with this match with Bronstein, that he was cheated there, too. Maybe, but... So it's an example of first someone who might have been driven insane by a world championship event, But then also like, oh yeah, dude, you don't say anything. You don't say anything. So you're not given the opportunity to be insane. It's really interesting to think about the culture we live in the West, where, you know, there's not only the various vices that are all around you that you can, I can go drink right now, or I can go to a pot shop now and just get incredibly stoned. I have all these things just at my fingertips. But one of the things I have is the ability to just sound off, such as we do on this fine podcast. Right. You know, and then especially if I have a high degree of self-confidence, I just won't stop. I just keep going and going and run with it.
Wait, so sorry. So yeah, so that's an example. Like you said, Zurich 1953 is fixed. Like this is like common knowledge.
Yeah.
Like, the greatest turn-in book of all time.
Yeah, that was a surprise. There's a book called Smyslov on the Couch.
Sasanko, right?
Sasanko, right? And Sasanko is really a great historian and knows all these stories. Nice. And he goes into depth in it, in that one, you know, in that book. Okay. That was kind of where I got turned on to the details of that kind of fixing. Now, but as in the case with Bronstein, it's not the case that fixing is going to necessarily stop you from going insane. You know, maybe it'll might relieve some of the tension, though. It's true. Like you're playing in those interzonal events and they're going to draw with each other, which isn't necessarily to your advantage to draw, but they're going to usually draw with each other, maybe a thrown game here or there. And then, you know, they pick their battles. Kind of the way, honestly, Nepo tried to win this latest candidates tournament. He tried to pick out who he's going to play for a win against. Didn't work out.
Yeah. But it worked twice. Anyway, it could help you manage your stress.
Exactly. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. So then the next one we get to is Bobby Fischer. Raise your hand if he went crazy.
Yeah, his thing is kind of well documented.
By the way, I really recommend John Donaldson's book he published a couple of years ago. Amazing, deep documentation of all the stuff that went down, especially after Bobby drifted into a place that no one knew where he was. Like in the 80s, especially in the 80s, he's living on the streets in LA. Nobody really knew. There's a couple people who knew. But now with that book, he really showed us what was going on, and it's deep and it's fascinating, man.
Yeah.
Also the run up to the world championship and his whole this Church of God thing or whatever it was amazing. Very interesting stuff.
On a topic that you've mentioned a couple times, Fischer was somebody who took issue to being called a chess genius once and said, no, I'm an all around genius, right?
Yeah. He definitely believed he was an all around
genius. Yeah. He said I'm just a genius who happens to play chess.
Yeah, I'm an all-around genius who happens to play chess.
Okay, I feel like one name we got to give credit to, because I didn't even think of him as a candidate for this list, is Vichy. I just feel very sane, no objections. Yeah. good moral standing, it seems.
Yeah, not even any made-up stories circling about him. Nothing. Yeah. Squeaky clean.
I think the craziest thing the guy ever did was sing Roxanne really amazingly.
That was good.
That was really good, dude.
Yeah.
Okay. And well, and that takes us to the present day.
That takes us to so we got Ding.
Fischer, Kasparov, Kramnik, Ding, maybe Hinson, Carlson. We could, you know, I think Carlson has been touched. You know, is he insane? I wouldn't say that, but he's been touched by this world championship thing. It has broken him to some degree. And that's kind of part of the discussion. Is he saying conspiratorial things? Thank God, no. At least not yet. Not yet. He doesn't sound off on things he doesn't know about. And the guy is so smart, dude. Like, he is. Here is an amazing thing where you might want to talk about an all-around genius. First of all, you ask that guy any kind of geographical question, arcane knowledge, the guy's got it on his memory instantly. But he won this, there's this whole soccer what fan
fantasy big, league, yeah,
fantasy league that's big. It is a big deal, and the fact that he could win that thing, whoa, that's really impressive, dude. You know, so
yeah.
He is applying his mind to other areas, and is able to actually do it.
Well, see. I feel like Magnus, you know, he started playing some poker and doing some stuff.
Yeah.
Like doing the fantasy chess thing. I don't know. I feel like jury's still out.
Yeah.
I actually think I think the lawsuit kind of took a lot out of him, from what I can tell. I feel like that kind of like, because they like shut him up for a while, like now he can't really say a lot of stuff because he puts him to the case in jeopardy. Mm-hmm. And public opinion wasn't exactly on his side for a lot of it. So
actually, we could, in terms of conspiratorial things, we might as well mention this. So Netflix apparently is actually going to do this Magnus Niemann thing. Amazing. Would I consider it conspiratorial what he did? Maybe a little bit. Maybe a little. It was an off-the-cuff thing. Right, to accuse Niemann because you're upset, you know, and you think everyone's cheating anyway. So he did have a little Kramnik moment. Just go ahead and say that was a Kramnik moment there, in the sense that he didn't have any actual proof and he went overboard and kind of doubled down, right? Mm-hmm. As you do. Yeah.
I think it may have hurt him a little bit that, you know, lots of people took Niemann's side. That may have surprised and dismayed him.
Mm-hmm.
And then also having to police what you say based on lawyers, it's very annoying. That would be another source of dissonance for me, for sure.
Mm-hmm.
I've already said my piece for today about Magnus. I think his mental health is clean. Obviously, there's stress in his life, but yeah. I think he's managed it.
Yeah, and one of the reasons I thought this would be a timely podcast is just the Ding thing coming up, right? And we don't know. So it's kind of like by looking back into history at these players and their encounters with the world championship match, it forces or introduces this question, which is a key thing going on. When we ended the candidates and we gave our predictions, everyone was basically bullish on Gukesh beating Ding. Not so much that Gukesh is that much better, but just that Ding, no one knows what's going on with the guy. And he's going to get a warm-up tournament at the end of this month, I believe. He's going to play Fabi and a bunch of other top players. So we're going to get a sense of what's going on there. My guess is it's not going to look good because the guy's not in form and it's been looking bad. But we're going to see, right? We're going to see.
Yeah. No, definitely. Ding is a big question right now. And I guess we'll wrap up the episode. I mean, overall, it feels like there's huge pressure and stress from the world championship, the road to the world championship. That affects players different ways. There's also huge stress that comes with the crown itself. I don't know. From my perspective in general, I feel like chess, it's easy to get sucked in. You know, life is very complicated, but the chessboard is confined to the 64 squares. It's easy to try and solve the game when nothing else seems to be going right in your life. So it's very conducive to this like obsession, and I feel like that's where a lot of player struggles seem to come from.
Oh, I'm surprised we're wrapping up already. but we certainly can if you want. But
give us some last thoughts, David. Give us some last thoughts.
Jeez.
You can go long.
Do you have a lot more thoughts?
Well, I can skip over a couple things, and you know, you can argue or disagree if something I say is controversial. But with Kramnik, okay, I think he's kind of gone crazy here, unfortunately. And I didn't, you know, try to dismiss him immediately, and I can certainly believe there's a lot of cheating, and I like him. I don't trust how chess.com handles cheating because it's too opaque. And when things are too opaque, how do you trust them, you know? That doesn't mean that, like, I'm on Hans's side in that whole story. Obviously, Hans was a liar and a cheater. But But you just can't have full faith in chess.com because partly they're like hiding and protecting and second chances. And did they give third chances? And like, and Hans certainly got like a third or a fourth chance after suing them. And that's so weird and all that. But let's just say I can understand that he would be worried about cheating. I can understand that he wouldn't trust things. But so I didn't dismiss him. But here's the thing. I feel like what he's doing does not come from a place of like, I'm just trying to make chess better. I feel like it comes from a place of he's upset, he's wounded, he's hurt, and he's crazy. So it's about the origin of what he's doing. It's not about whether he's right or he's wrong, even. He could be totally right. Every single person he accuses could be cheating. And I would still say it looks like the dude's crazy. Because what's in it? Why is he pursuing it like that? Doesn't he have something else to do? Can't he use, you know, capitals and periods and stuff when he writes? You know, like Jesse, you recently learned that if you write something on the internet with alternating capitals and lowercase capitals and lowercases, it's a way of saying that you're speaking from, you're parroting the voice of somebody who's deranged.
Right.
You learned that trick. Well, like when you look at Kramnik's posts on chess.com, they were like that. They were like the scrawlings of a madman. It was like up and down, long things, strings of like uppercase letters, no periods. He's posting his articles as his chess.com profile. It's like he can't even figure out how at first how to like write something up, have a friend edit it, post it on a blog, you know, with a written by me and a title and a date. And those are little frills, but it shows that you're in control of what you're doing, right? And the way he was just like putting the stuff out there was like, this guy is hurt and upset. He's wounded. It's like, it's, and I could guess, and maybe I overstep, but it could be that it like, he can't accept that there could be somebody 20 years younger than him who can't beat him in classical chess, who can beat him in blitz. Or it could be something else, right? But like something just like got his, like touched his coconuts, and he lost it. He became enraged. It's not about cleaning up the chess world. It's about a dude who's mad that his coconuts have been touched like repeatedly. And I think the more people like jeer about it, the more he feels his coconuts have been touched and continues to fight for his coconuts.
Yeah.
And, you know, to me, it's sad for him to be so upset about it, because you guys know my take on cheating is people are going to cheat. I despise them, but I'm not going to spend time being upset about it.
Right.
I rather enjoy chess as much as I can and accept that a certain amount of the time I'm going to get cheated against. And like, just let it be, because I believe that we hurt ourselves more by being upset about it than by just going with it. Not in the sense that I support cheating or anything, right? But like, I feel like we do more damage to ourselves getting upset about it than the cheaters initially do by cheating us.
Yeah.
You
guys can listen to the pod too. When I had him on here, I was like, bro, you need to dial this as a fan. Dial it down for me, man. Let it go. Let it go. And he was like, no. Let it go.
Yeah. So that's my take. I know a lot of people think he's crazy, and I know some people think he's not, and they're like upset that and offended that people would say that. But I would say from like the presentation, all this, I feel like this is a man who's like personally upset to an absolutely unusual degree. And, you know, yes, fighting cheaters could be good. Yes, trying to protect the integrity of the game could be good. I mean, I agree with all that. But I fear at the same time, with full sympathy, that he's in a place of great pain and upsetness. You know, so to me, I put him on the list, and I wonder if, you know, something about the being the world champion, you know, reaching that apex, having only the ability to go down and lose people's estimation from the period, from the point where you're the slayer of Kasparov, the inventor of the Berlin Wall, etc. You know, if that, to me, it's very likely that that contributes to where he is emotionally right now.
Right.
And I add him to the list, I put Ding on the list as well. And then I look at, you know, 17 people on our list of world champions and or, you know, unofficial world champions. And we look at, you know, six who are crazy out of 17, and it's too much. It's a pattern, you know.
It's definitely a pattern, yeah.
So my answer to Jesse's question, this is Jesse's topic, everybody. My answer is, like, yeah, I think that being world champion is very conducive to going crazy. And I don't think it's just like a selection bias that like people who are crazy try to become world champion. I think the path and the result and the aftermath, each of these things has different ways of driving somebody crazy. Mm-hmm. Which I think in general, life can drive anybody crazy, whatever life they choose, you know, but this is doing it with a higher incidence.
And actually, one of the only thing that I disagree with David here is that David thinks it's then reasonable to step back from the world championship, where I'm like, Magnus, this is part of the romance, dude. The flirting with madness, dude. The going for it, going towards the absolute edge of what your mind can do. Oh, it's great, dude. It's great that you could die in this quest. He makes it even better, dude. Wow. What a great thing.
Okay, wait. Before we go back to Magnus, let's talk about Kramnik a bit, because I feel like we did open up a lot there. So, I kind of think it's one of those things where it's like in politics when, like, the more the two sides argue, the more they get kind of locked into their own position. Okay. And it's impossible to, like, dissuade someone from arguing against them. And I think that's kind of what's happening with Kramnik, where obviously he feels like he's on the correct side of things. There are many top players that behind the scenes support him that aren't willing to come out publicly and tweet, yeah, I also believe there's tons of cheating. But we've heard Naka talk lots about online cheating. We've heard Nepo, Caruana. And I'm sure behind the scenes, there's lots of these top guys that are probably like encouraging him and egging him on and being like, yes, like you're doing the Lord's work here, talking about all these cheaters. You know, I mean, another one is Kamsky on his stream. He's just accusing people left and right, basically. So I do feel like Kramnik, yeah, believes he's righteous. I would agree that the way he's going about it is incorrect, especially when it comes to like accusing kids of cheating. You know, it's one thing to accuse, let's say, an adult player without hard evidence of being a cheater, especially he should understand someone of his weight and reputation. When he levies an accusation against like an unknown FM because he had like a good title Tuesday, that basically like destroys that FM's world. You know, it's just like the worst thing that can happen to you. Like a world champion like publicly calls you out and like shames you. And, you know, let's hope that Kramnik is right, because if he's not, he just completely, you know, killed the guy's like, you know, chess career, and maybe not his whole career, but it just like totally wrecked that guy's chess life. He's accusing kids, like he's accusing other top players. So that's too much. It's like, it's not the right way to go about it, even if the ultimate conclusion is correct. I think, and he might be right, like as David is saying, that like chess.com, maybe they're not doing enough to combat cheating. Personally, I think they're very much against cheating, like we all are, but it's a very difficult problem to solve. But anyways, even if you believe that, it doesn't necessarily give you the right to be this vigilante and just start executing people on social media just because they look suspicious or what have you. And so it does
reflect on something and then write up about it once you're feeling a bit better and you've talked to a friend and show it to a friend before you publish it, right? But like, if you're accusing somebody during a game or 5 seconds after a game, like you haven't reflected on it, right? You're just like firing at random.
Yeah. It's an emotional reaction, it seems. Yeah. And it does damage the game. I mean, you know, as much as cheating damages the game, false accusation also damage the game, because now you have players just like sending nasty messages to each other afterwards. You have people that are much lower levels, not playing titled events. You know, they lose a game, they accuse their opponent of cheating, you know, it ruins their day. And in all likelihood, their opponent wasn't cheating. It's just this hysteria that's been brought on. Now everyone's suspicious of everyone else. Every time their opponent makes a weird move, they're like, oh, what's going on here? And it's like, this is, yeah, definitely not a good aspect of the game. So, yeah, it's a tough thing. I think also I feel like the toxicity of social media has maybe gotten into Kramnik a little bit, where he sees all these comments on his blog, all these anonymous Twitter accounts responding to him, and then he's responding back to them. It's like, Vlad, what are you doing? These are like 12-year-old kids that are just like trolling you, and you're like writing back to them and like getting upset over what they're saying. And you know, I've been in some Twitter kerfuffles myself. You know, it's not pleasant. You know, you're constantly checking your notifications. People are mentioning you. You're an idiot. Like, you're ruining the game. And yeah, I can see it only fueling the anger and the rage. But I wouldn't call it crazy. I think crazy, you know, is like a loaded word. But you know, maybe it's not the most healthy thing in the world for Kramnik to be doing, for sure.
Millennials don't like using the word crazy, though, do they? But
yeah, no, of course. Yeah, mean.
Of course.
Mean word.
It's a loaded term, and it's been used to, you know, dismiss people and so forth. I mean, and we didn't start our episode off with sort of like a breakdown of what we mean by it and like, you know, figuring out all our terms. There's nothing scientific about our discussion. And even if we were professionals licensed to diagnose people as crazy, no longer, I think, an official diagnosis in the latest DSMs. But even if we were, then we would know that you can't diagnose people from a distance who are not your patients and blah, 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 right? But this is just a...
That's a historical overview.
It's just like a general discussion of, you know, the stress and pain and effects of a career at the top of chess. And hopefully people can understand what we're talking about.
Yeah, absolutely.
And all of this with like the greatest of, you know, respect and sympathy for these people. We're not trying to dismiss them or say anything bad about them. And hopefully it comes through that we're lovers of chess and of the greatest chess players that there have been, right?
Yeah.
Whatever, you know, absolutely, whatever tournament hall they may or may not have defecated in, we still appreciate them. Yeah. You know, we're still in love with them.
Absolutely. I mean, I was trying to drop hints all episode that chess is driving me crazy and I feel all the pain and stress that these guys do. Like, I totally, totally get it. So, yeah, nothing but the greatest respect for their chess and the efforts that they took to get to where they are.
Cool.
All right, folks, that'll do it. Thanks for listening. Catch you next time.
Yeah, feel free to rage on us in the comments section and see if we lose it.